Hi, folks. Again, sorry if you hear the sound of the fan whizzing in the background. It's a bit warm in here. It's, for some reason, I find it hard to balance the thermostat and the fan. So that's a problem I need to work out. Today, we talked about power last week. We'll talk about socialization. Which is a really important subject in sociology, perhaps one of the most important subjects that we have in my field. Socialization is used in sociology differently than most people use the term. When most people use the word socialization, what they mean is to associate. So people will say, I'm going to go out tonight and socialize. Well, that's not how we use the word socialization in sociology. When we say socialization, we mean social learning. Something like conditioning, but perhaps not exactly the same, because conditioning is more of a psychological perspective on social learning. Socialization is a sociological perspective, so the implications of the terms are a bit different. But basically, socialization is the way in which we internalize culture, including values and norms and beliefs and language, from parents, from teachers, from friends, from the media, and so forth, into our minds. So ultimately, socialization is about culture coming into our minds and how we ends up internalizing culture so that it becomes a part of us. That's ultimately what socialization is. We'll talk about some aspects of socialization today, hopefully add an additional perspective to what is contained in the book. One of the theories which is discussed in the chapter that deals most with socialization is the theory of symbolic interactionism. Now, symbolic interactionism was discussed earlier in the book in chapter 1, but in this chapter it goes into symbolic interactionism in much more depth. So we'll focus on that primarily as an example of how sociologists, or at least some sociologists, view socialization. I am not personally a symbolic interactionist, but when I was working on my PhD, my major professor, which is kind of like an advisor, was a symbolic interactionist. He's now long retired, although we're still friends. His name is Ron Neff. He's back in his original home in Iowa. I knew him when he was living in Mississippi, and I got my PhD at Mississippi State University. And we used to have all these debates about symbolic interactionism versus other perspectives, because I'm not a symbolic interactionist, although I found the perspective to be fascinating, and so our discussions were always interesting and illuminating. Symbolic interactionism was started primarily by George Herbert Mead at the University of Chicago. Now, Mead was not in the sociology department. Instead, he was in the philosophy department, although he did teach courses that were both in philosophy and in sociology. Mead worked together with some other people who actually were in the sociology department. In particular, William I. Thomas and Charles Horton Cooley. Charles Horton Cooley was actually at the University of Michigan, but they all kind of were a part of what is generally referred to as the Chicago School of Sociology, because it was a school, meaning a tradition of sociology that was centered around the Chicago area. Now, Mead had a very interesting perspective on the self. And his perspective on the self was, in a way, linguistic. Now, before we talk about that, we'll talk about the perspective on the self that was developed by Charles Horton Cooley, which is mentioned in your book, because Mead's view of the self was informed greatly by the views of Charles Horton Cooley. As your book discusses, Cooley's view of the self is referred to generally as the looking glass self. Now, a looking glass is a mirror. I suppose Cooley could have said the mirror itself, but looking glass self is a lot more colorful, sort of brings up images of Alice in Wonderland going through the looking glass. And what Cooley said is that the self is a looking glass which reflects how we think others view us. Now, the key word in what I just said is how we think. Why? Because we don't have telepathy. We don't have the ability to read people's minds. And so our ability to understand the views of others is based upon subjective interpretation. So in effect, we are constantly evaluating and interpreting the actions of others and trying to make sense out of them, to become more informed about how other people see us. And our self, the self, is a product of how we interpret, how we think other people see us, in effect. It's our interpretations of how other people see us. That is the self. So what that means is that from Cooley's perspective, we are not born with a self. The self is not innate. We are certainly born with the potential to have a self, but we don't actually have one at birth. The self is formed through socialization, meaning as we interact with others, we incorporate their expectations into our minds. And as we do that, we develop a self. There have been many studies, for example, on the subject of self-esteem, which have been informed by Cooley's perspective on the looking glass self. And those perspectives have found something rather interesting. Many people have argued that most people have low self-esteem. Well, that is not supported by the research. For example, if most of us get a photograph and we are in the photograph, who is the first person that we will look at or look for? Well, of course, it's generally ourselves. Now, if we had low self-esteem, or if most people had low self-esteem, as some pop psychologists, meaning psychologists without training in psychology, claim sometimes, then you would not expect that to be the case. You would expect that we would instead look away from ourselves and look at others. But that's not the way it is. We look at ourselves and we try to see how well we are looking. We want to make sure that our hair is combed properly or brushed properly for women, making sure that our makeup is on appropriately, making sure that we are dressed in an appropriate way, and so forth. So that's basically what the looking glass self tells us, is that, in fact, we do, most of us, have pretty high self-esteem. Surprisingly, I would imagine to some people, some of the people with the highest self-esteem are people that we would not expect to have high self-esteem, like convicted criminals, people who are sentenced to life. They think they're wonderful. Now, everyone else may, or some people, especially their victims, may think otherwise, but generally people who are in prison have a very good self-image. They have very high self-esteem. Self-esteem is simply how we compare our own self-concepts with others and how we evaluate the relationship. So if I think that my self-concept or my concept of myself is higher than others, I have high self-esteem. If I think that my self-concept is lower, then I have low self-esteem. But again, most of us do have relatively high self-esteem throughout most of our lives. That does not mean that we constantly do. Certainly, we go through ups and downs in our lives, and there are periods during which we may have low self-esteem. But for the most part, we have high self-esteem. So let's take that as a kind of bridge to go back to the ideas of George Herbert Mead. Because Mead based his view of the self on the looking glass self of Charles Horton Cooley. Now, Mead's view of the self was extraordinarily creative. What I mean by that is that he developed a view of the self which is linguistic. And we don't ordinarily think of the self as linguistic. Now, when he did this, he didn't mean literally that the self was a part of language, but he felt that a linguistic metaphor did a good job of putting the self in a proper perspective. So, for example, he said that the self has two basic dimensions, the me and the I. Each of us, according to Mead, has many me's, but only one I. The me, or the me's that we have, are our roles. Roles are expected behavior. Obviously, we all have many different roles. I have one role when I'm teaching classes. I have one role when I'm with my friends. I have one role when I'm chatting with my sister over the phone, and so forth. In other words, I have different roles. And say, for example, I was chatting with my friends and I began lecturing them as I am right now, my friends would probably think there was something wrong with me, and probably there would be. In other words, there is an appropriate time for every kind of behavior, and there are also inappropriate times. So, we have many different me's, we have many different roles, and depending upon the situation that we are in on a particular occasion, we will draw this me out of our minds, because ultimately that's where the self is. That, according to me, the self is in the mind. The me in particular is in our memories. That's where the self lies. That's where the me's lie, in our memories. We have memories of how we are expected to behave in this situation or that situation, and then we learn from experience what is the appropriate way to behave in a particular situation. If something doesn't work, then we generally won't repeat that behavior and instead we'll try something else. So we learn basically through experience. Now, this notion of the me is very, very similar to Cooley's looking glass self. Again, the looking glass self, which is formed by how we think others look at us, is similar to the me, which is also a product of how other people see us or how we think other people see us. It's a product of the interpretations of others. In other words, Mead would agree with Cooley that we are not actually born with a self. The self is something which develops and is formed through the process of socialization. Now, the second aspect of the self, according to George Herbert Mead, is the I. The I is the performance. It's what I do. So again, it's linguistic. What I do is the I. What people do to me is the me. Let's take that and put it into the form of a sentence. John threw the ball to me, and I tried to catch it. That's one possibility. I could also say, John threw the ball to me, and I ran away. I could also say, John threw the ball to me, and I ducked. I could also say, John threw the ball to me, and I filed charges of assault and battery, which, of course, would be kind of silly, but I could. But generally, I will do what is expected of me. Notice that I used I and me in that sentence. I will do what is expected of me. That is what keeps society, from a symbolic interactionist perspective, running in order. That's what we learn through socialization. We learn how to behave in a way which is in conformity with the expectations of other people, especially with the expectations of people that that really matter to us. So we have many me's, many roles in different situations, but we only have one I. We only have one performance. It is the I that thinks, the I that acts, the I that believes, the I that behaves, and so on and so on and so on. That is the way in which Mead developed the notion of the self. There is some similarity, although not exactly, to Freud's view of the self, which of course is based on the classic notion of the id, the ego, and the superego, which, by the way, look entirely different in the original German. The id, as I understand it, not being a psychiatrist or a psychologist, being something like the lower self or the animalistic self. The superego being something like the conscience. And the ego being the rational self, which makes a decision, which kind of negotiates between the ego and the id. Some people have tried to make comparisons between Mead's notion of the I and the me and Freud's concept of the id, the ego, and the superego. I think that can be done to a limited extent, but it can also be taken too far. Now let's go back to Mead for a moment. Mead also talked about something called the generalized other. The generalized other, I sometimes say, is a kind of soup or stew made of me's, meaning it's a collection of all of the me's that reside in my memory. That's the generalized other. And so when I, notice I use the word I, the performance, or the performer, when I am making a decision, what is expected of me, again, the expectations of others, I will turn to this generalized other, which exists in the memory, and I will make a decision about what is the most appropriate course of conduct to take in that particular situation. So that's pretty much a summary of the symbolic interactionist view of the self. I'll mention one last thing, and that is that one symbolic interactionist by the name of Irving Goffman, who was discussed in a later chapter. Irving is spelled E-R-V-I-N-G, because that's the German spelling, and then Goffman is G-O-F-F-M-A-N. Irving Goffman took the notion of symbolic interactionism and socialization and turned it into a performance. So to Goffman, the expectations of others are others in the audience, and the actor is performing to the audience. So the actor as the I is conforming to the expectations that the actor will perform appropriately in that particular play. The actor is is the individual, in a sense, the I. The individuals in the audience, in a sense, are like the me. And so Goffman used that kind of metaphor to kind of show or illustrate the way in which there is that kind of dialogue, constant dialogue in our heads between what is acceptable behavior in a certain situation and what, on the other hand, might be seen as unacceptable behavior. And generally, when we weigh the alternatives, kind of weigh the pros and cons of a particular action, we will choose the one that has, we think, the most favorable outcomes in our lives. And that ends our lecture for this week. Have a good week, and I'll speak with you next time.